Right, everybody, welcome to The Oath, first ever episode. It's feeling pretty cosy in here. We're at Suburban Home Studios in deepest, darkest Burley. And I'm joined by Matt Johnson, Suburban Home Studios.
Hi.
I'm joined by Ed Waring of Hope and Social.
Hi.
And I'm joined by our special guest today, Paul Marshall.
Hi.
AKA Lone Wolf.
Hi.
That's both of them just saying hi there.
Hi.
And John Folger, who produced Paul's most recent album, The Lovers.
Kind of, yep. Hello.
Kind of. Don't do yourself down, John. And we're also joined by me, Tom Woodhead, of Hippocratic Mastering.
How many of you are there in here?
So many of us. So today, what we're going to talk about, first of all, is we're going to talk about the relationship, transition between being a musician and being an engineer. And I assume that everyone who is an engineer here was a musician before they were an engineer. So...
I've got a question. Who still is a musician? Because I'm still a musician.
kind of.
I pretend.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really... I'm not really at the moment. I wouldn't refer to myself
as
a musician. Well...
Wait for the reunion, Cash.
You could do a Don't Look Back, like an ATP one. Play your first album in full.
Yeah, we could do that. I'm not sure how many people would come, but I'm not sure we could command ATP Don't Look Back fees, to be honest. Ed, how did you get started in engineering, and what was the process? What was it like?
Before I was in Hope and Social, I was with most of the same people in a band called 4 Day Hombre, and we'd been to some studios and it had not turned out so great, and there was a decision made that we should buy some gear to do demos with, and I was actually totally against it. I was like, we'll just spend all the time messing with the gear, we won't make music, and it'll just be a pain. But everyone else, no, we should do it. So we put some money on some credit cards, and we bought a desk, and we bought a proper recording computer, and some monitors, and we...
What year was this?
This was about 2002. Yeah, so it was running Cubase VST.
I remember that.
Automation was awful.
A high school staple of the early noughties.
And we got it all, and it took us 3 days to set it up. I can remember it taking 6 hours to get any sound into the computer. I can remember all that stuff. And then we recorded 3 songs, and it took us 3 months to record 3 songs. And because I'd done all the research, and I was against this, because we'll spend all our time messing with gear, we won't make any music, I ended up running everything. And I can remember looking at the desk and looking at a channel and going, well, I know what the treble's for. I know what the bass is for. There's these knobs in the middle. What are they for?
That's the band.
and like, I can remember stuff like...
You're now describing the thought process of every single DJ in the country. Standing up there.
Welcome to Radio 2.
I'll just turn them all up. And I can remember stuff like, for a whole year, we were like, we're never going to use artificial reverb. So we had to use spacers, we had to use stairwells and stuff. I can remember when we're trying to mix something, you know, like mix creep, where you keep trying to make everything louder. Well, yeah. We'd run out of desk. I'm like, what do we do? How do you deal with that?
You just have to cut some extra little slots into the faders and push them even further up.
What we did was we actually sent stuff out on an auxiliary and bought it back on return, so we could actually make it louder, even though we'd run out of fader. And it was kind of awful, but for some reason I got into it, and then kind of kept doing it. And
do you think that being an engineer has made you a better musician?
No, the opposite.
It's made you a worse musician.
In some ways, yeah. because we record ourselves and we still do that. Whenever we're kind of making music, you know, making new music, mm-hmm. I've pretty much got to have 2 brains.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this is a problem that any band that tries to record themselves has. You've got to continually be able to kind of balance the musical side, which is kind of free and magical, with the analytical side of engineering. You know, is everything at the right level? There's for right mics. And then on top of that as well, which we're gonna, I think we're going to talk about later, is like you're going to have the producer brain as well. Like, is all the stuff that's happening right for this song? And so as you're writing, it's just...
Yeah,
and so it's actually kind of made it harder for me to be a successful musician.
Right. Do you not think in some ways it's if you understand the big picture a little more, then you can be a little less indulgent in your parts?
Yeah, things totally. Like stuff like that's kind of helpful. But then I don't get enough time
because
we went out recently and we reckon we've recorded like 80 songs in total.
Right.
You know, like, which I've pretty much, apart from 10 of them, 12 of them, something like that, like, I've engineered. And I just keep thinking about all that playing time that I missed out on. like that's a lot of playing time, you know, that I've just spent, you know, because especially at the start, it was all such a battle, you know. Mm. Like, worrying about what mics is where, and, oh, no!
John, did you guys... this is Duels, by the way, listeners. John is in a band called Duels. And they recorded their second album themselves after working with producers for the first album. And did you find it difficult having that kind of extra responsibility?
I kind of stayed out of it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I've never been particularly technical.
No.
And so I kind of... I've learned a little bit as I've gone along. Yeah. It's been, you know, recording Paul's album was a big kind of...
But do you think, John and James...
We always recorded our demos to a pretty high standard, and it was only that it got up to release standard, you know, well, actually I say release standard, the first stuff that we did when we first started a band together back in, it was like 2002 or something.
Right.
It went on to Radio 1 just out of our bedroom doing it on, I can't remember what...
that was when you were still Sam
...program we used, yeah, but it was just... horrible little program that we used. It sounded awful.
Microsoft Word.
It was as well.
It was on Word. Yeah, it was all pasted into Word. But it sounded terrible, but it worked, you know, and it got out there. And I suppose that taught us that actually you can do it. I don't think there was ever... We never really felt the pressure of the technical side of things. No, and I think John Mayer, was always really interested in that side of it, more so than James Kenosha, actually, who's gone on to obviously be a well-known producer now, so... Yeah, I don't think we felt the pressure of it so much. But
what about you, Matt? When did you first start recording?
The first thing I recorded that I got paid for was a record for a band called Woodison from Sheffield. About
I mastered that. Oh,
I mixed their last album.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mastered it.
And you mastered it.
Yeah.
So incestuous.
I was doing a tape label with my girlfriend at the time, and Woodison couldn't afford to record, and I had some crappy little kind of inbox thing, and I said, well, I'll do it. So we hired a warehouse for a day, recorded it, sounded pretty bad. But I really enjoyed it, had a nice time. I'd been recording for a long time on my own and recording demos for my own bands.
Yeah.
But...
Did you record the releases for... Was it Held by Hands?
No, that was recorded on some... that was recorded at Leeds Met by a student.
Right, okay.
You know, one of those where someone's got to make a record and you go in and no one's happy with what happens afterwards. Yeah, but the Hookworms is the first time... My band, Hookworms, is the first time I've ever recorded everything. And it's been... I think the way that we record songs, it's kind of the recording, the editing is really intrinsic in the songwriting, because we'll tend to jam out songs here and we'll record all of our parts live, and then I take the parts, and then I spend months faffing with it, like completely changing how everything sounds, and we tend to learn the recordings then that I've created rather than the original jams that we did.
And then do you re-record it?
No, we just keep it like that. And then that's why I think we've been doing quite a lot of like live bootlegs and things, because our songs are changing all the time.
Yeah.
The first time we play it live is usually when we've learnt the recording that we've made, and then
so when you're editing the recording together, you're all playing live. Are all the amps in this room in this live room?
It depends. It depends on like kind of what we're going for at the time. Sometimes we'll just track bass and drums. We have done it when everything's been in this room, and then we've gone back and changed it all. We have gone back and re-recorded parts before. I've edited guitars together, and then Sam, who plays in our band, has come back and played that guitar part himself.
Yeah.
So do you actually sometimes make the song yourself then out of the jam? Is that basically what you're saying?
Pretty much all our songs are like that.
So you kind of... So what you were saying was like you've actually taken some of the things that he's played, and then actually kind of made a totally different guitar part out of
it. Yeah, pretty much.
Right, that's cool.
Like, well, things usually come. I think our band's very rhythm orientated, and with the bass as well.
Mm.
Like, Matt will come with a bass line, and we'll jam around that bass line. The bass line will usually stay for the majority of the song, and then I have this kind of need to turn it into a crafted song, whereas mm-hmm. the others would have to play the same thing for 10 minutes and play guitar solo. Yeah. I try my best to put a song in there as well. So we're lucky that because this is my job here, that we're able to do that. I know other bands aren't so fortunate.
That's cool, man.
I think the thing you said earlier as well about only using spaces, you know, rather than artificial reverb, I definitely went through that period as well where...
I think it's once you hear what it can sound like, then you get a little bit obsessed with it.
Yeah,
Like, also as well, it's because of not understanding reverb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'd bring up reverb and go, oh, it just sounds awful. It sounds like the 80s.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh, I can take all the top out of it. That's kind of interesting. That's loads nicer.
Some of those kind of using spaces for it, I still think it's the best.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like when on The Devil and I, the first album, there's some massive kind of cavernous drums on that, and all that was we had the theatre that we recorded in had like a dome, almost like a mosque dome at the front of the theatre, and so all the way through recording the drums we just had two mics set up just in the middle of that dome, and then all the doors were shut around it, and then we kind of forgot they were there but just always had them recording, and then in the end a lot of the reverb that we used on all the drum tracks came from just what happened in that dome.
Kind of like, and our studio, which is the crypt of a church, and you come in and it's like this stone hallway, and then you go through another set of double doors, and you're into the crypt, and put two mics out there, and I'll that's my hall, and I'll gate that off kick and snare, and that's my drum.
There you go.
You know, and it, like, and you know, it's Led Zeppelin, it's amazing. But it can be.
I think what we were sort of saying, isn't it? Like, is it does sound amazing, but there's no reason to limit yourself to just doing that.
Yes.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
I saw a really interesting interview with Craig from Elbow, the keyboard player from Elbow, and like they record for themselves now. Like, that's what they do. And he was saying that, I think, not on the album before, he said, anything where anyone sounds far away, they're actually far away. Like you know, they actually, you know, oh, we need a voice coming from far away. Well, go and stand 20 metres away then. You know,
it's nice if you've got a 20 metre.
But like this corridor, that'd be
it. Yeah, I was going to say that. It's wild out there. But there's a song on the new Hook Quims record we just did where... I ran the entire song, the entire final mix down the corridor, and then I merged the two together, and it sounds really ethereal.
I saw a video you posted online of some kind of guitar thing being played through the corridor.
Yeah, I do it a lot. Like, I've recorded just drums, taken drums out there as well, because I've got like a lot of stage
box. Do you never
have
any problems with noise or anything?
No, it's all right. The rest of this building is all a cake factory, apart from my unit, and they start at some god awful time at like 10 to 5 in the morning, and it's always really embarrassing when I'm here, and I'm like sat outside and drinking a cup of tea, and they come and they go morning, and I'm like, oh, not really. I was still here when you left last night. But they leave at about 4:30 on in an afternoon, and they're not here on a weekend, so we always do it in the day on a weekend.
Right. That's cool.
Apart from they leave Radio 4 on sometimes because they think it deters burglars.
Oh.
Well, burglars.
Because burglars hate Radio 4. They're not chamber voices of southerners. Posh people.
They're just not as educated.
I was going to say, I think it's more like, hang on a minute, that sounds like sentences actually strung together. Maybe we should leave.
Sorry, did I just kill that?
I felt like Tom was actually leaving a real point.
No, it just shows my lack of preparation trying to think of something else to say now.
Yeah. It was the thought of sentences strung together that just knocked you out of the ballpark.
I got a record to mix recently that had, they tracked the drums in a warehouse, and it sounded great until you realised there were bits where you really wanted to pull the sound of that warehouse out of the microphones, and all it was two overheads, a kick and a snare, and that was cool when they were going for the Albini tracks, but then when they had the quiet ones that you wanted to be really up front, it was a real nightmare, like trying to pull anything out of it.
It's
have you heard that Metz album?
Mm.
See, because that sounds mental. I think that just sounds like they've just set up a mic in the corner of the room and just just gone for it, you know. Yeah. But it's like, I don't know, that's an example though of like, well, it's the opposite of the ethereal massive reverb to just a boxy room just full of guys smashing the crap out of everything, you know. Yeah. It sounds really cool though.
That record's great. I really, really like it.
Yeah, it's really good.
Was it an album like 4 or 5 years ago that was recorded in a grain silo?
Yes, who was that?
I can't remember who it was.
He did an interview in Tape Op.
I know it from. And a grain silo, it's like a massive dome metal tube thing. Yeah, and they recorded the whole album in there, but somehow got access
with
to
the grain in or out.
The album, it was pretty much just a kind of crinkling sound. As
okay,
side.
Guys, you've only got 10 minutes.
This is the last take. Okay, final take. Yeah, but like they had really dead drums. It's really. No, it didn't. They're really massive.
Another record that sounds like that, though, that Metz one is the Goat record as well.
Yeah, man.
Another one that just sounds like it was recorded in a box, but it sounds amazing because of it. Do you not think?
Don't put this bit in, but I'm doing a remix of a song on that record, and I've heard the stems. And
what's that sound?
It's a pretty interesting. It's a pretty wild sound.
I love it. I mean, I love the way it sounds in general.
It sounds great. It's got like this total kind of nostalgic vibe to it.
It sounds like you only live twice.
Room was it? That sounds awesome.
If you've ever watched You Only Live Twice, basically, if you watch that film with muted and listen to the Goat album. And it's just the perfect match.
That's amazing.
It's unbelievable.
That's such a great record.
Sold.
Why is that?
Well, it's really kind of, I mean, ignoring the fact that they bang on about the fact that, you know, they may or may not practice voodoo in this, like, Swedish little weird village
they've emailed me. They're totally normal.
Yeah, I know they're normal. But it's like it sounds like I don't know, that it's got a kind of a tribal sound to it. It's almost like it's like weird kind of tribal prog. That's kind of what it sounds like.
There's lots of like the singer wailing in the background.
But why does that relate to You Only Live Twice?
Well, have you seen it?
Probably, but I can't remember.
Well, it's just because
it's
just full of crazy kind of
which Bond,
odd,
which
odd Caribbean dancing.
Which
and,
Bond is it?
Is it Sean Connery? Or is it Roger Moore? No, it's Roger Moore.
Yeah, I don't like Roger Moore.
Well, I remember the only quote I remember from that is when Roger Moore says, "What's your name?" to the main character, and he says, "Names is for tombstones, baby." that's the only thing I can really remember.
My cousin works in a Pizza Express in Edinburgh, and Roger Moore came into his Pizza Express and demanded to be seated, but he couldn't because there were no seats, and he got in a real huff about it, and he kept complaining about it, and my cousin eventually told him, "Oh, sorry, we can't seat you because Sean Connery's sat down there."
I was going to say, this has got to be a joke. There's got to be a punchline somewhere.
It's not a punchline, it actually happened.
Do you think they were actually going to start on one another or something like that? Do you reckon?
Oh, I don't know.
Who's the best?
I do like the idea of Sean Connery and Roger Moore having a fight in a Pizza Express.
Oh God!
It's in Edinburgh as well. It's, you know, Sean Connery's turf. you don't come into Connery's turf and mess with it.
Especially
if you're an inferior Bond already. Yeah.
Yeah, I reckon alleged wife beater Sean Connery would take him apart.
And what mic would you use?
Well, on.
Just trying to bring it back.
That was perfect timing as well.
Well, in a fight.
Yeah.
RE20, it's heavy. It's got, you can grip it really.
It's got to be a ribbon mic, isn't it? Strangle someone with the inside.
You'd break it.
Oh, no, it snaps straight away.
Yeah, but that's because you're nice. You'd just be like, "Oh, sorry, only joking. I'm not really going to strangle you."
I'd use a shotgun mic.
Hey!
Boom! Hey, was that a pun as well, or what?
Boom!
All right then, ladies and gentlemen, let's continue this conversation.
So, Tom, why don't you tell us about what happened with you? What's your story?
I got into engineering. I was in a band called Forward Russia, and
what was that sound?
Who did that?
It was me.
All right.
I do apologise. I was just merely doing the old shit band jibe.
Oh, right. Okay.
No, they were a very good band.
I thought it was a real fart.
It wasn't a real fart.
And Whiskers, the guitarist from that band, was supposed to be here tonight, but he's ill, unfortunately. So best wishes to Whiskers. And I I was just always really interested in the recording aspects, and we recorded with a couple of different producers, and I just started recording bands after that, and did that for a couple of years, as well as doing live sound before I got into mastering, and sort of realised that if you do mastering, then you don't have to deal with people quite so often. So,
So,
I like people really, but got into mastering and realised that you only had to work on one record a day, which is a lot, to me, is preferable to working on one record for a month or for a couple of weeks or however long. So, and now, I'm enjoying helping lots of people with their stuff rather than just working on the odd thing. So it's fun. And maybe that's a good time to have a quick break. You've got spies in my heart.
Maybe we should all have an effect on our voices.
I won't flinch.
I was just about to claim it, and you took it.
I'll take chorus then if you'll take a flinch.
Well, it's the same thing, but just faster. We're just discussing which effect we should have on our voices. If you're going to have a massive reverb, it's like...
Oh, I've got to have... I think space. Because I think a lot of people are really disappointed when they meet me for the first time after having seen my band.
And your voice doesn't sound like that.
I double dare you.
You're like right in my chest.
Yeah.
Because if I ever got asked to go and like do guest vocals on a record, do I take it with me?
Yes.
Yes. No one wants to hear me sing.
Absolutely.
Well, funnily enough, it's when I used to work at the Met, there was a lassie came to the counter, and you just reminded me because you were saying about, you know, people are really disappointed when my voice doesn't actually sound like that. It's like, so you'd have to have some kind of headset on and some kind of like little mini PA with you or whatever, you know, the whole time. This girl came to the counter once and she brought me a microphone. She was like, "There's something wrong with it. It doesn't work properly." I was like, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I was doing an interview in the street. And when I spoke into it, my voice didn't get louder."
That's amazing.
I didn't know. Like, you know, when you just look at someone, you're just like, I'm so sorry to have to tell you what an absolute moron you are. But she was like, she thought she was just going to hear her voice get really loud in the street. No one could hear her, and she's standing again. Is this thing up? Just not plugged into anything.
A friend of mine used to work at Sound Control, and they sold a guitar to some 14-year-old kid. And 2 weeks later, the mum brought it back in angry as anything. She's like, "This is broken. I can't believe that you've sold us this crap, you know." And so they took it back and they plugged it in and they tuned it and they gave it back to her.
Oh no!
Yes, you have to tune them. Yes, yes. No, God. We can't do that every time. No.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, like, it didn't auto-play Red Hot Chili Peppers riffs. Like, it was totally worthless.
Yes, yes, the guitar's broken because he can't play it.
That's my worst nightmare, working in a guitar shop. Having to listen to, like, Under the Bridge over and over. Maybe in stereo, like, in different keys.
Enter Sandman.
Yeah. I was really hung up. We were on tour once, and I was really hung over in Brighton one day, and I went into what's it called, GAC in Brighton, because my friend works in there, just to hang out. And that place, has anyone ever been there? It's like a cave.
I didn't realise that that was the same. You mean like GAC, the website?
Yeah,
I didn't realise
it
was that place in Brighton, because I have been there.
It goes
like,
really far back.
All these little tunnels, and
I got a little bit lost, and I ended up in a room with a man just playing funk slap bass.
Is that by the sea?
Is it
in one of the caves?
Brighton is by the sea.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else you want to know?
Does it have a beach? No, but is it in those kind of arches by the right by the sea?
You know, where all of like the little kind of hipster shops are? There's like about three lanes of them.
Yeah,
it's
I think
at the
I
end of
mean.
One of them.
I've got you.
But yeah, I was just stuck in. I was in this little cove with a man playing funk slap bass, like proper like Jaco Pastorius shit, like. And I just stood. I was really hungover, and I did just stand, just staring at him, like just like almost like a whitey, just like staring at him completely.
I'd love to see a video of that.
It was beyond my comprehension. I didn't understand what was happening at all.
I was once in a car with Matty from Dinosaur Pilot, and he was really drunk. I think he'd just done a gig or something, and whoever was driving had some soul music on, and he's like, "Hold on, this doesn't have a riff. Is this funk music? Am I listening to funk music? He's phoning people. I'm listening to funk music. It's good.
Surely it's something that Glacken had come out with, isn't it? If it doesn't have a riff, then it's not music.
Surely funk music tends to have riffs.
Nah, but not a real riff. Not like,
what, you mean it's got
this
like
is a Leeds Music
notes.
Forum conversation yeah, happening right here, right now. Yeah. This is a thread by...
I walked in to see Glacken the other day at his office, and the first thing I saw was Bellhouse playing air guitar, just with his headphones in, just fucking riffing. And I nearly just turned around and walked straight back out.
They call that work. They get paid to do that as well. Just sitting there all day, just slagging all their close friends up. Bellhouse. Bellhouse is a good story.
Shout out to Bellhouse, if you're listening.
Nah, this isn't a conspiracy theory podcast, so he's not going to be on that.
Is Bellhouse really into conspiracy?
Yeah, last time I went round his house, he had like two screens going. He had Russia Today in front of him. Then he had like some Ike documentary, and then he had a laptop on each hand, and they were all like checking out like really weird underground websites.
He had a laptop on each hand.
Yeah. He'll get really upset as well because I said conspiracy, and he says he's only interested in empirical fact.
That's quality. Empirical fact.
Empirical fact.
He was really excited. What's the guy called? The really fat dude in New Zealand that owned Mega Upload that got raided by the FBI.
Oh, he's got something.
Kim.com. Yeah, he just made friends with Kim.com on Facebook, and he was really excited about it.
Oh, man.
That's... really excited. And then it turned out that Kim.com had deleted him.
You can do that when you call Kim.com. You can just delete people.
His surname is .com.
Yeah, he had it changed. You've got to look up this guy. He's amazing. He's one of the ugliest people you've ever seen. And all the pictures of him are with like these like kind of like page 3 model women on his private jet. And he's just got his arms around them in a jacuzzi. And this guy's amazing.
Was he number one at Modern Warfare or something?
Yeah, he was number one at Modern Warfare for a long time.
Yeah.
Like, something to be proud of.
Absolutely.
that's a life right
How
there.
How does he run his incredibly badly designed websites while he's there?
He has a safe room in his house. When they actually came to get him, he was in this basically like this chamber, this safe locked down with food supplies for months and Jesus. Guns and stuff.
And a PlayStation.
And I think maybe he was Xbox.
Oh, okay, yeah. And an Xbox, yeah.
I was going to say, though, I did get to number 69 in the world at Doodle Jump the other day.
What the hell?
Whoa,
new podcast.
I only got to do it for a day. And then and I took a screenshot of it and I kept it and I haven't played it since. I can't go back. I was just sat on the toilet for about an hour and a half. My legs had gone numb and I couldn't walk. After that, I just kept going. It just wouldn't stop. It's like, it's usually that.
Are
little...
you still talking about the game?
Yeah. This is Doodle Jump.
Musician's life right here. Yeah. This is a window.
But and number 69 as well. How apt. That's just me through and through.
How are your piles?
Oh, they're not good.
When we come back, we'll be talking to Paul Marshall, a.k.a. Lone Wolf. And John Folger, a.k.a. John Folger.
A.k.a. John Folger.
About the making of Paul's new album, The Lovers. So we'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to the second part of The Oath, coming from Suburban Home Studios. I'm Tom from Hippocratic Mastering, and we're here with Paul Marshall.
Hello.
A.k.a. Lone Wolf, and we're here to talk about the making of his latest album, The Lovers. So why don't you tell us, for a start, about the genesis of the album, when you started writing it, why you started writing it?
Well, the thing was that the album I did before that, I demoed the hell out of it, basically. I recorded everything, demoed everything, so by the time I got to the studio, it was just the whole hideous process of trying to match what had already been done, but just in, you know, doing that thing where you try and record the same song but just a bit better, and then it ends up kind of not having the same feel as your demos or whatever. But then so for The Lovers, it was I'd been trying to follow in the footsteps of what people like Woo, Stalking Horse, and now what Owen's been doing from, you know, his new project Department M, and kind of go into the studio blind and work with, you know, a producer or producers to kind of try and get the best out of you in the time that you're there. So I chose to, I recorded a bunch of, maybe 30 or 40 kind of little 10 to 15 second snippets of stuff on my mobile phone. Like, I recorded just like a guitar line rather than a song, or played something on the piano or whatever, and then basically collected all of these together. And then when we got into the studio, it was just a case of saying, right, I'm going to make a song out of, this one today. And then I'd listen to that riff and I'd go and sit in the studio. So
how long were you in the studio for?
We were, the whole thing only took about 2 weeks in total, didn't it? Was it about 2 weeks? Two and a half?
It was in total, yeah. It was over a number of months, but it was only...
You did a song a day?
Pardon?
Did you do a song a day? Or?
No, that was an unfortunate slip of the tongue, though, wasn't it? No, it was. We kind of would work on something for like 2 hours, and then or 2.5 hours or something like that, and then until I started getting a little bit
antsy,
brain fried, and then have a half an hour off, and then we'd try and start another one, and then we kept trying to just keep it fresh all the time, so that my brain was kind of constantly just spilling out whatever felt right at the time.
So, what made you ask John to be a part of it?
I love him. Yeah, well, yeah, I'm a massive fan of the Barbarians movie and the last Jules album. It was it blew me away. I loved it. I thought it was an amazing record. And then and John and I started to become friends once John started seeing his future wife, Fran Rogers, who was a close friend of mine. And we got on. I don't know. We just seemed to like a lot of the same things, and like a lot of the characteristics of the same things, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So
we played in the band together as well. I mean,
of course, yeah.
Needed
that happened to kind of before back him up for the record,
the
yeah.
Devil and I, yeah. So you had various people involved, didn't you?
Yeah,
it was me. It was Woo played as well. Kenosha was your drummer for most of it, wasn't he?
Linz Mabbitt,
who played cello with Grammatics. James Mabbitt, Napoleon III. My brother was on Jim guitar played, at one point, wasn't he?
At one point it was like three quarters of Jules.
And Jules, yeah. So it went from there, really. I think, you know, obviously we met because Paul liked the album, and actually you were good friends with Fran as well, weren't you? So, it was really, I found out a lot more about kind of where Paul was coming from musically, I suppose, when mm-hmm. we got involved in the band and that kind of thing. And I think when we approached the new album, when Paul started playing me his demos of what he was writing, it became a lot more obvious that he was coming from a place that was a bit more about him as a person, I think.
Yeah.
I hope you don't mind me saying this, but I think the first album, well, his second album, but the first is Lone Wolf, The Devil and I, there was more of a mask kind of up front, you know. I think it was your songwriting,
definitely,
wasn't there?
Yeah.
And the new stuff to me felt a lot more like he was coming from a place that I knew him as a person, you know. There was a lot more of the influences that he talked about,
and you'd
which
be in a fairly unique position to judge that, being someone who knows him well
yeah.
And also knows the music.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't produced the record before, I hadn't done anything like that, so, you know, I'd done stuff with Jules, but the only reason that I was kind of interested in getting involved really was because I felt like I did not just know him as a musician but as a person as well. Mm-hmm. So it made a lot of sense to me that I could offer him something and say, yeah, well, this makes a lot of sense where you're going with this record. And he talked to me about what he wanted to do, and it was quite drastic from what we'd been playing, you know, as his backup band. Mm-hmm. And that was how the discussions first started, really, wasn't it? Because you said, this is the kind of thing I want to do for the new album. Yeah. And I basically said, you shouldn't do that. So that was how our in-studio relationship started and probably continued from there.
It was good, though.
I think Paul made the natural... You know, a lot of musicians, I think, if you've done something and maybe you're a little bit kind of... You're not sure how it's been perceived, the first thing that you probably do is go, right, I'm going to try something else. You know, I'm going to try something completely different. And my opinion was that I thought that Paul, he had a fan base out there, you know, and he had people that really liked that record. So I thought it was a bit drastic to kind of go in a completely different direction and completely change everything he was about. If he was going to do that, then probably it was best to do a different project or something.
But it's definitely something that a lot of bands do, isn't it? On the second album, they kind of go, we want to change everything about
definitely.
I think with Forward Russia as well, when we started writing our second record, Whiskers was very good at making sure we didn't do that. So I think there were certain things, you know, that I would say, maybe like, you know, I don't want there to be any disco beats or things like that.
Right.
And there didn't end up being that many on the album anyway, but... it's important not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, basically.
It's more like, though, what I was trying to get at was I don't like to do the same thing twice either. And what it was I started getting stuck in this kind of... I mean, there's other things that I could talk about, other reasons for writing in a certain way that I could talk about. But, it's you know, I felt like maybe perhaps a certain sound was expected of me as well.
Yeah.
And so, therefore... you know, not just by fans, but and it's that kind of thing where I started writing kind of acoustic stuff again. And I was like, oh, this is boring the living shit out of me. Do you know what I mean? I was just like, I just don't feel like I'm getting any enjoyment out of it at all. I can do it, but I don't want to do it. Do you know what I mean? It's like I could keep writing these kind of ditties like they're going out of fashion, but I just don't want to do it anymore, you know? Yeah. And all it was, I just wanted to feel like I wanted to make an album that I want to listen to and actually, because it's the kind of thing that I really do listen to and not something I'm trying to craft. It's something I want it to just be, I want you to hear what's actually happening up there, you know, in my brain, and rather than just kind of, than some kind of, I don't know, like some kind of big kind of theatrical thing that I'm putting on for, you know, for the show, if you see what I mean. And what it was like with John there, like John just kind of reined me in quite a bit when I wanted to go a little bit too far left field, you know, because I've got to a point where I wanted to put loads of kind of electronic beats on the record and just a few things where he'd just kind of say, well, you might not want to do that because there's nowhere else on the record where that kind of beat appears. And so therefore it might be a bit too bizarre to throw it in there. It might be better to, if you're going to do it, do a whole record like that rather than kind of just throw it in for the sake of it. And I didn't understand that at first because I wanted to just be, you know, do whatever I wanted kind of thing, you know. And in a way I kind of still do, but I'd like to do that maybe, like you say, like under a different project, just do another kind of brain vomit record where I just literally do whatever feels right at the time. But
it was about keeping threads, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was keeping.
I mean,
it
I think in, you know, yeah. it's a big change anyway.
Yeah,
the songs are a big change, and they were a change in a positive way, I think, because they were much more honest, like I said. But it was just about keeping those elements of it. So, like Paul's guitar playing, I thought was a big part of the first record. And so, actually, you know, the guitar playing is still in there, but it was just on this new record is all on electric guitar.
Yeah, and it was mainly acoustic guitar on the first.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was much more kind of acoustic album. Yeah. So, yeah,
but the guitar's more of a texture on this album than this is the thing as well. You know, you can't strip it down to the solo track underneath. It's like it's about layering up the textures and making it.
It would miss a lot without the guitar, though. I mean, it's still an intrinsic part of a lot of the songs, I think, right?
Yeah, maybe some of them at least. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I mean, not every single song, but I think one of the things that I like about the record is that it's quite short.
That was always the plan.
It came out a lot worse than it sounded, actually.
I love it when it ends. I love that silence after the last track.
But it's quite brave in a way to release a... What is a set? It's nine tracks, but it's eight tracks, really.
Technically,
How long is it in minutes?
33...
See, point. I think that's a nice length. Yeah. You always want to leave people wanting more.
Well, it's, we're in an age where no one... I don't believe people, you know, apart from people who love music, you know, really sit down and listen to a full record in the same way anymore, because it's everything's so available. So you, you know, you hear about this new band, you know, and you click them on Spotify and you listen to the first two tracks and you decide whether you like them or not based on those two tracks or the first 10 seconds of the first
I went
track.
To one of those like music conference things recently where there was a fairly well-known blogger, music blogger there, and he said that when he hears that something's good, he turns it on, he listens to it, and by the time the track's finished, he's already published to his WordPress what he thinks about it. I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, exactly, like, this is it.
Like, I spent 6 months working on something and you're just going to decide at the drop of a hat whether it's any good or not straight away. It's mind-blowing.
Well, there could be the most brilliant epiphany of all time 30 seconds from the end, but he's already published it by the time it gets to the end.
But that's exactly it. I mean, I remember when I was younger and I was listening to Park Life, you know, like when I was, I don't know, I would have been 13 when that came out. And because it was on cassette, I used to just kind of get to the end of side one and then go off and do something else. And then it took me ages to listen to side two. And then it was possibly about 2 months or 3 months after I got it down the line.
But surely you have to rewind it again to listen to side one again. You could have just clicked play.
I could have. But I don't know why this happened. But all I'm going to say is, though, 3 months down the line, when I suddenly heard "This Is a Low" for the first time, and I was like,
oh my God!
So what the bloody hell have I been doing? Like, you know, what the fuck? It's like... And I realised all the really interesting shit was on side B, you know. It's like, what the fuck?
We've actually got a rule that our albums have to be... They have to fit on one side of a D90, so it's got to be 45 minutes, or you've got to lose half a song, or you've got to decide, you know, which song you take off. Because like, I'm old enough that we swap songs, albums on tape. Mm-hmm. And all the best albums fit on one side.
Yeah, I was going to say that was like a really important part of the sequencing of the album that Hookworms just made, that we wanted to make sure it wasn't a double LP, because I hate them. Mm-hmm. Like the new Tame Impala record is really great. I love that record, but it's a double LP, and so you get two or three songs aside and you've got to go and turn it over.
Especially when you're making it.
What about that amazing new triple album from Green Day? I mean,
that's actually three separate albums, Paul.
But how does
Uno, Doze, and
but aren't they all in the same ticket?
So is it the same as Extreme Free Size to Every Story?
I don't know that record.
Oh,
Jesus!
Not very good.
Showing your age again, there. Right?
I think I am. Yeah.
But the long and short of it was that was quite a decent pun there, actually. But yes, the long and short of it was that we wanted it to be so short to the point where, you know, I'd like the listener to get kind of to the end of it. And do that kind of double take and think, shit, is it finished already? Kind of thing. I'm going to have to go back and listen to it again. You know, even if they lost their attention because they were doing something else, it's like it's I don't know.
It's nice to have a chorus just happen once. I mean, more and more, I've been producing a records I've been working on rather than just engineering them, and I've always been keen to encourage people to do less, as it were, because if there's a good hook, just have it less times and people will listen to it again. You just don't want to wear things out, do you? And it's the same with a record. Mm. Like the first time I sent, the day we finished our record, I sent it to some people, and the first email I got back, someone said, it's a bit short. I was like, dude, it's 45 minutes long. What do you want?
How much time have you got?
But it's kind of like, the difference is in a band like yours, you know, and if you look at, you know, great bands that do use repetition as part of their kind of part of their sound, so to speak, like, you know, something like Noi, like, you know, we've talked about it before, but it's like, if you go back and listen to Noi, I mean, I really have a clue how I can sit there for 17 minutes and just listen to the same drum beat that goes...
It's the greatest drum beat ever.
But it's just so
really
weird.
This is the only one I know how to play.
But you say, like, you should, you know, if you find a good riff, you should maybe play it less, but obviously that sometimes it works the complete opposite way. You should just keep playing again and again.
If anyone's heard my band, I sound like a hypocrite now.
Yeah. What, all these people that keep doing the same thing again and again and again.
That's definitely my... That's the thing, like, with the editing thing that I do with our records, though, that the others would happily play for 20 minutes. And, like, the first time we recorded... The first demo we recorded of the first song on our record, it was 18 minutes long, and now it's 7, and that's my fault, really.
That's still long, though. It's still a long track.
If you'd kept the if you kept the original timings, then maybe this person would have been a bit happier. She comes, gets back to you a few weeks later and says, just finished listening to the record. I love it. My favourite thing about it is that it's just really long.
I think it needs to be a bit longer. I don't think anyone's ever said that, have they? Have they ever actually said, I think it just needs to be a bit longer?
Well,
loads of times. I guess.
You what, sorry?
Loads of times. Mainly girls.
Oh, well, of course.
I've got a question. Before you actually went to the studio, like, did you have like a manifesto? Had you set out ideas? Had you rules?
Yeah. I mean, we knew what we wanted it to sound like, didn't we? I mean, we knew kind of how, like, where we wanted to go with it. We had like certain kind of, like you say, like certain guidelines and things. And I went in with just those ideas. We did have two songs, because obviously we had Needles and Threads and Swan and Meander, because we'd been playing them live before.
Yeah.
But it was those two tracks that kind of made me realise that I wanted to go, like, because they were kind of, them themselves were made very kind of haphazardly, so to speak, just quick. And I think it was after, you know, we knew we wanted to keep within some kind of zone that they're in, and we'd been listening to a lot of, I don't know, I just wanted it to sound classy. I wanted it to sound like, I just wanted it to sound like a kind of, well, you wanted to say like a modern soul record. That was the original.
Yeah, it's quite soulful.
I think that's
record,
the thing. We wanted it to sound like an electric soul album. You know, what I mean, that kind of thing.
And
I think we kind of got there. You know, especially on the vinyl, it works really nicely, I think.
It's interesting.
But like I mean, we made decisions based on that idea, didn't we? Like, you know, you wouldn't harmonize with yourself.
Yeah.
And there'd be just one guitar, as if it was Paul playing his electric guitar and singing over the you know, the whole record.
I think that's one thing about the record is that it's quite produced, but
simple.
But it's almost produced on top of a very raw start, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And like then you get to the last song, which is, it's called The Lovers, right? And that's just
bass
the raw
and vocals.
Yeah, it's almost like that's what the rest of the record would be without all the production.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool.
That song's got something that links in with what we were talking about before. It's like the little chord change that happens just as it fades out at the end, you know, where you've got that something that happens in the song that makes you want to just put it on again to listen to it. You know, it's not something that happens three times in the song.
That was an accident as well, wasn't it? It was like, it was an accident that just had to stay there.
Because
it was that kind of thing where I'd recorded myself just playing that keyboard part round and round and round and round and round. It was that kind of thing where we decided it was going to have to end at some point, you know. and so me and Laura were just doing that vocal part at the end where we just keep repeating the same thing. And we didn't really know how it was going to end. It was that kind of thing of, how are we going to stop it? And then James said, well, I'll put a fade out in for now and then we'll tackle that later. But then we listen to the fade out and it does that little change back into the chorus just as it's about, I don't know, like
that's a very old sort of classic thing, isn't it? The sort of old fade outs on like Jimi Hendrix records and stuff like that, where they just kind of, they're fading out and then something really weird happens right at the end just as it's fading out.
Tom Waits was a bastard for that as well. On what's that track on Rain Dogs, the Downtown Train? And a massive sax solo comes in about a second just before it starts fading out. It literally just goes...
And he's just like, I want to hear what that sounds like. Yeah.
I'm like, you can't do that to me, you bastard.
Well, there's like the Portishead record, The Rip, where fantastic keyboard comes in. This is something we talked about a lot, because John Carpenter movies were something that influenced like the keyboards on Paul's album and stuff. But on that song, the keyboard riff comes in right at the end and then just fades out straight away as soon as it starts.
I
think
it's ripped
off from Laurie Anderson. But
they're bastards on that record as well. But they're bastards on the sudden cut-off on that record. They get you all excited and then they just go, uh-oh, and just pull the plug. It's like, just as you're getting, it's getting really amazing. Stop, you know.
So I'm going to ask about it. It's a bit sensationalist.
Come on.
But I know you've talked about it in the past with me, and I know you guys clashed a little bit. No. At the start? Well, if the first couple of days of recording, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, to be fair, it was... me and Kenosha started recording it. John was coming about 2 days later, weren't you? So me and Kenosha kind of already had 2 days in the studio ourselves.
And Kenosha was engineering the record.
Well, he's producing it too.
He was producing
it
as well.
Yeah, it was like a combined... Thing, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we all made crucial decisions about it and stuff. But Kenosha and I kind of had to make a start, mm-hmm. you know, obviously. And so, but it was that kind of thing where it all felt like everything at the time, because you're so excited about what you're doing and you may be looking at it all with rose-tinted glasses. It was that kind of thing where it felt like it was all going really great. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't wait to show John. And then John showed up and it was just...
It's all shit. No,
that was my response.
It wasn't quite like that at all. It was just John wasn't quite as excited about it as we were, and it was that and it was just then suddenly the shift in kind of that John had different ideas.
Yeah.
And then I had to go through that horrible thing that it's not nice for any artist to have to do and just actually accept someone else's ideas, and it took a while.
I think the big difference was that I'd been in a band for years and Paul hadn't. Yeah. He's always been doing stuff by himself, yeah. So he makes all the decisions himself. So
well,
I was kind
of politics of amazing.
I mean, I was used to arguing with people about stuff, you know, and it kind of, I didn't feel like we were making a record unless you had people had strong opinions about stuff, and I was just used to kind of people kind of saying, well, no, I think it should be like this, and like, and having some comeback, and you have a bit of a, you know, set to about
it. I guess
and Paul wasn't used to that, so to me, it felt natural to do that and get, you know, be opinionated.
But
about
there's
it,
no but point in you being there if you're not going to challenge what he's saying. Right?
I think so, yeah, that and exactly that's kind of what we got to in the end, which is how it worked out, I think.
But once we had that conversation, it was all.
Yeah, I think you need to when you're making a record, don't you? You need to have a bit of a falling out, and need to kind of. It shows that everybody cares about it. Otherwise, you're just sitting there, like, kind of on your laptop checking Facebook or whatever. You know, it's.
I've been in plenty of studios where people say that.
You know, I'd rather be having an argument with somebody than they're checking
engaged
Facebook,
in the record.
You know,
I mean? But we never. I mean, just for the record, we never actually fell out in inverted commas. It was just that.
Well, you didn't
thing.
Fall out just for the record. I mean, it was a. It's a lifelong commitment.
No, it was like I just remember there was. It was just that kind of thing where. You wanted me to try a few things, and then I started having that kind of attitude. Well, no, I don't want to do that. You know, it's kind of like, you know, why don't you just try this? Because it might actually be really fucking amazing. and then instead of me thinking that it's going to be amazing, it's going to ruin it if I do that. You know, it's that kind of thing. No, I'm not going to try that really amazing thing at all. You know, it's
and,
like,
you know, now we've got. Like Pro Tools or whatever, and you can just try things.
You can just try stuff, and then if it don't work, you don't have to use it. But it was just that whole kind of, I don't know, it was a fear of not being in control. I think that was the thing. It was just allowing the kind of the control to kind of be shared between three people rather than me just telling people what I want to do, you know, which I've done in the past. And so, and which was the whole point of bringing these two along in the first place. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I think it was an interesting experience, and one now that I'm glad I did, and because once we did, like I said, once we did have that chat, and it was all kind of like, right, let's have a beer and chill out, and then let's get back to work. And as soon as we did go back to work after that, then I don't think we ever had any form of kind of
no, I made
conversation.
A lot easier, didn't it? Yeah.
I just
stares.
I just nodded at him every time I wanted him to do something.
I think it's a really important thing, and I've seen the opposite in lots of situations. I think it's a really important thing that in a creative situation where you're working as a group, and it's especially true in bands, that there's an atmosphere where you can say, I don't like that. And it doesn't cause a massive ruction.
Mm.
Where you can say, I don't like that. And, and then people go, okay, why don't you like that? And they can talk about it and actually build something that's better.
When you've got someone in a band who doesn't necessarily have that attitude, it can be very difficult as well.
Yeah.
If the rest of the group has an attitude of, you know, you can say what you like, and there's one person who gets really precious about it, it can cause, like, big problems.
Sometimes one of my roles when I'm kind of acting as a producer, I find, one of the roles that I find is that I'll say what people can't say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that can be an important...
And I'll spot the tension, and I'll go, actually, those two hate this.
Yeah.
You two love it.
I mean,
those two hate it.
That's a big part of being a producer, I think. Yeah. And that's what we found when we were working on this record, is that James Kenosha, he's the producer. You know, he's kind of, you know, that's why I said at the beginning of this, like, I'm not sure whether I produced it, because I was there to kind of, I suppose, advise on stuff.
But you Kenosha is very good at that,
which I think is a big style, you know, a big point of being a producer is actually knowing how to deal with people.
Yeah.
He's great at that. Like that.
And he's really good
Kenosha's
at it.
Kenosha's brilliant with me.
And it's something that I've done a couple of sessions with him, you know, since that record and a couple of things before, but not in the same kind of detail. But I don't have that skill that he has that is, you know, I was going to say manipulating people. That sounds horrible.
Jedi mind games. You know, just call it mind games. We call it Jedi mind games.
It's just,
like you just lead people on a path. You go, right, 3 hours time, I want you to be playing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that is what is best for your record. Like, you know,
Well, it's more like he could tell me that he knows when I'm getting pissed off, or he knows when I'm... He knows, like, if I'm doing a vocal take and I just can't get a certain part or whatever, you know what I mean? He just somehow manages to make me do it. I don't really know how he does.
I think that's one thing, having spoken earlier about coming as an artist to being an engineer stroke producer, and I think we should talk about what producer is, because we haven't talked about that, and everyone's using the word and like, I still don't know.
It's a very nebulous
sure.
term, isn't it, especially in this
day
and age.
There's something about being a musician, in that I can remember what it feels like to be rubbish. I can remember what it feels like not to be able to play it. I can remember that feeling of being in the studio and everyone looking at me and thinking, I really should play this, but I don't know what I'm playing, you know, and having to work all that stuff out, and I can see that in people. I can go, actually, you find this hard.
Mm.
Yeah, this is, you know, you've done it so many times now, that's too hard. You're never going to hit that note in the way that you're trying to, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like,
it's making people feel at ease, isn't it?
Yeah, you got to make them feel like they're not stupid or they're not useless, you know what I mean?
And also making them feel like, that this, what's going on at the moment, is the most important thing.
Yeah,
like, that's happening in the world at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. This is why we're here. This is why we're all here together. I mean, it's like, you know, it's that whole kind of thing of people saying that their baby is the most beautiful baby in the entire world. You know what I mean? It's because to them it is, and so therefore it's the same when you're making a record, isn't it? It's got to it's got to be the most important thing there is. I'm not saying the best record in the entire world, but you've got to at least try.
You've got to try and make the best record in the entire world.
Exactly. And I should just state for the record that, by the way, when we were talking about the altercations and stuff like that, it was my problem. Not John. I'm always frightened that when we have
this
kind of
stuff. This has been said.
When I go, you know, you two kind of clashed a little bit, didn't you? And I always say, yeah, well, John came in and did this, and John came in and did that.
It's
John,
a shame that.
And when John turned up, everything went to shit. And really, it's because I couldn't handle it, not because John did anything wrong. You know?
It's a shame that James Kenosha couldn't be here, because he would have probably offered a third viewpoint on the whole affair.
And I don't think you're attractive.
Just make
us
feel really good about ourselves. But
you can't have James Kenosha on a podcast that doesn't have a video camera.
Well, possibly. he wanted to come, but he's so famous and successful that he couldn't find the time. So
I know exactly how that feels. Hey, James, can I book some time in your studio? I'm sorry, I'm far too
that's
famous.
That's what happens
and,
when you're damn good.
I think there's nowhere to land a helicopter around here, so he can't. There's no way he could get here.
And his jaw doesn't fit through that door, is it?
So,
jaw Kenosha.
Love you, Kenosha.
So, I'm still intrigued by this, what does a producer do? Like, we talked a lot about producers in studios, but producers don't always work in studios. Like, you know, like a lot of production for me takes place before the studio.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. You know, arrangement and
arrangement, like and talking, you know, getting the ideas, getting the vibe. Like, again, like Rick Rubin, I think Rick Rubin's an excellent example, and he finds the studio a bit boring because he's like, I've done all the work already. Mm. We know what we're going to do. The recording studio is just where the work gets done. Mm. Yeah, that's just technical. Yeah. We've already agreed and thought about what it's going to feel and sound like.
Well, I mean, yeah, it makes sense. Like, you hear about
such a little writing about that as well. Like, the first time I went and did pre-production on a record, I actually stood in the corner of the room and I was thinking, I've no idea why I'm. What am I meant to be doing?
Well,
like, you can read so much about the process of recording and even like the psychological process of
the
recording.
First time,
actually,
pre-production, more than any other element of making a record, is it's so situation specific.
Yeah.
So more than any other thing, like, you know, you can read about how to mic up a drum kit, and it probably won't give you any useful advice without actually doing it. But you know, you can get some basic pointers. You can read about how to mix. You can read about all this stuff, but you can't really read about how to do pre-production, because basically you're taking a set of songs and then you're thinking, well, these might be absolutely fine as they are. They might, you might need to change something. You might not. Like, it's completely situation dependent.
So. I remember, you know, Tom, Pulled Apart by Horses, yeah. Tom, when they went to work with Gil Norton on their last record, and they went into, they did something like 2 weeks worth of pre-production or whatever, and it was that thing where they just went and rehearsed, and Gil Norton was just there watching them rehearse, and he was basically making loads of decisions about their songs there, you know, and he was kind of saying, you know, right, okay, I think you should maybe try that without that chorus. And I remember Tom saying that he was starting to get pretty pissed off, like after the first like day or two, because mainly because it was almost that same sort of thing, like what we were talking about the clash at the beginning, the initial clash.
Yeah, I mean, they've worked on those songs for months and months. And demoed them. He comes here and listens to them once,
And then Paul and he says, "As they, you come in here, you're not even a member of the band. You're ripping my song apart. You're telling me what I'm supposed to do and all this." And then afterwards, suddenly the songs all sound better and they don't really, or not necessarily better, but just more refined. Yeah. You know, it's that kind of, it's because he obviously, like I said, when we said about what's a producer, he obviously had a vision for the record based on the demos. So therefore,
I remember thinking the complete opposite when we were making our albums, is that the producers that we work with, didn't have that input at all.
Oh, really?
You know, didn't have that.
I was
meaning
to ask about like the when you made the early deal stuff with producers.
It was a real big disappointment, to be honest. Right. It's something, looking back on it, that, and it influenced the way that I wanted to do stuff with Paul, really, because for me, I think you should be really involved with the artist to the point where you know what they're about, you know what kind of record they want to make, and you can make your decisions based upon, you know, the knowledge that you have about them. And the experience that we had was going into the studio, and we were, you know, completely fresh to it. We didn't really know what we were doing. We never really did until later on when we kind of learned in the studio when we were recording our own records. But beforehand, like when we made our first Jules album, we had no idea what we were doing, and we kind of, I don't think we had a general idea of how we wanted it to sound, but it wasn't anything kind of specific. Yeah. And we had this kind of naive idea. Well, I don't think it's naive, actually. We had an idea that a producer would help us shape that record.
That's not naive.
Well, yeah, that's the kind of thing that I still stand by. It's not naive, I don't think. And it's, we worked with a number of producers. We did some recordings for the singles, and then we went on and did the album with James Ford in the end. And it was a good experience, you know. None of them. We worked with Jim Abbas, who went on to do the Arctic Monkeys album as well. Mm-hmm. We did some stuff with the guy who did the Franz Ferdinand records. I can't remember his name now.
Off the top of my head.
Yeah, anyway. And none of them had that kind of involvement. I don't know whether it was because they were working at a certain level where they were so busy that they didn't really get involved with bands and that's a kind of level or what, but... For me, I think if you're going
to
commit...
Easier when you're doing a whole album, presumably, as
opposed to doing singles and stuff, you're going to just test stuff out, aren't you? But the kind of experience we had with James Ford is that he was great to work with. He was a very personable guy, and I think he did a relatively good job, you know, with the album. But he didn't have that element that I would think, from a personal point of view, is really important.
When you guys were making,
get to know a band, you know.
When you guys were making Paul's record, did you talk about lyrics? Like,
no, not really. I mean, we kind of on briefly we talked about some bits and pieces, but I think there's kind of things that you don't really do. And I knew that Paul was really, you know, lyrics are his big thing. Mm-hmm. And I might have opinions about how I would write lyrics, but that's my opinion.
I don't, you know, mean like so much. Did you make suggestions about lyrics? I mean, did you talk about what the songs were about and about
a bit, really. The
lyrics behind the songs and how that would influence the
album? Yeah, not in a massive amount of detail, really. No. You know, just you get a sense of what it's about. But I don't think you have to go into much detail about what the individual songs are about. I mean, you always said that, you know, you made it clear from the start that you wanted the record to be, have an overarching theme about it.
Yeah,
so we talked about that as opposed to the individual songs.
Yeah. As a, like as a recordist, I've just used that word that I've made up. I talk about lyrics with singers when I don't think they're singing the song right. So I get them to explain the song to me.
Right. Okay.
And then I go, okay, go and do that. Like, kind of like when they're tight about it.
It's probably a good way
to
get someone into the right frame of mind to get them to explain what the song's about.
You know, and even in my own band, like, we don't really talk about lyrics. You know, only when, you know, I don't like that word is wrong, it feels wrong, or, you know, that line doesn't hang right. It's like, that's for singers.
I'm guessing you feel the same way, Matt.
We've never talked about lyrics in
I love that line in that song of yours, that one I can't hear.
thanks very much. That's my favourite.
I love that. That's the best one, I think.
Yeah.
No, it's only live. Like, I just, it's just a sonic attack, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just, your vocals are just a massive sonic of space echo, but like...
Well, it's a comfort blanket. That's why I started doing it.
Yeah, but it sounds ace, though.
Thanks. It's definitely why I started. I mean, I went through it. I used to sing in a hardcore band and it was fine. I could deal with it. And then when we started Hookworms, I started it because I wanted to play guitar again. And very quickly, me and Sam swapped roles and I went and played keyboard and he played guitar. And all of a sudden, I felt really open again. I felt really awkward about it because I wanted to play guitar. So I sang into a delay pedal. Didn't you used to sing into a delay pedal in Forward Russia?
I
kind of remember having a pedal.
I did it at practice, and then like
I think I was at one of those practices where you had a delay pedal.
Yeah, we did it into, but I would only turn it on for certain bits, and then we turned it to our first gig, and it turned out I didn't have an XLR to TRS cable, so I think I naively assumed that the venue would have one. So and after that, I just never did it again.
You did it in the Anteater stuff, though, didn't you?
Yeah, well, that was...
Not plug-in.
Yeah. Right. Well, on that note, I think we'll call it a day.
I want to check out these urinal cakes.
thanks for everyone for coming, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to The Oath. Thank you very much. Cheers. Thanks for listening to The Oath. Please follow us on Twitter at The Oath Podcast and on Tumblr at theoathpodcast.tumblr.com. The Lovers by Lone Wolf is available for pre-order now and is on general sale from the 12th of November. You can find Lone Wolf's website at www.lonewolfofficial.com. This podcast comes to you via Hippocratic Mastering. Do no harm to your carefully recorded and mixed audio. See you next time. How I used to see clear, like the That'll be a seamless edit when I get to it.
You took your top off for it as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I take my top off when I do edits. It can get, every time I do an edit, I take a piece of clothing off. And
oh my word!
Yeah,
we wanted to talk about relationships.
It's really contributed towards my minimal attitude to editing, to be honest, because it gets really cold.
Yeah.